Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. U.S.-Iranian negotiations have been dominating headlines for the past week as journalists waited in Lausanne, Switzerland to get word about the outcome of the negotiations. After a night of marathon negotiations, a 15-year deal was finally announced between Iran and the five permanent members of the U.N. Security Council. Specifics will be announced in the final agreement in June. Yesterday, President Obama called the deal a historic understanding with Iran. The New York Times reports that in a move not seen since before the Iranian Revolution in 1979, and to the surprise of many in both countries, Iranian government broadcasters aired President Obama's comments live. Joining us to discuss coverage of the deal is Chris Tonzing, editor of the Middle East Report and Information Project, and he joins us from Washington. Hi, Chris. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. We are also joined by David Sirota, senior editor for investigations for the International Business Times. David recently won an Izzy Award, which is named in memory of the late IF's Izzy Stone, the dissident journalist who challenged McCarthyism and the Vietnam War. David Sirota won the award for his exposés on corruption in the country's $3 trillion pension system. Judges said these abuses hurt taxpayers and government employees while rewarding Wall Street firms that fatten politicians' campaign coffers. And David joins us from Denver, Colorado. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show, and congratulations on your award.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So David Sirota, let's start with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, because I'm partial to International Business Times, and I read International Business Times a lot, I thought that my colleagues at International Business Times produced a number of excellent stories on the upcoming Chicago mayor's race. Yesterday, Matthew Cunningham Cook produced a terrific story about the mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, who is in a very tough reelection race, blocking the release of more than 1,500 emails from his top donor, between his top donor and city officials. And I think, you know, it's a reminder that stories about governments blocking the release of information are important to both to public policy and to keep up the drumbeat of reminding the public of why open records laws are so important and so important to be enforced.
Who is Rahm Emanuel's top donor?
It's a CEO named Michael Sachs, who is the CEO of a company called Grosvenor. He and his wife have given the mayor $1.6 million. And as I said, there are, according to the city of Chicago, 1,500 emails between the mayor, his top aide, and the mayor's top donor. And the city, despite Illinois' open records laws, will not release those emails until, at minimum, after the election, and possibly never.
And according to the Chicago Times, Rahm Emanuel has raised more than $20 million for his reelection campaign. Again, this is for a mayoral race, $20 million. And then Chuy Garcia has raised $3.5 million. And the runoff is this Tuesday. This is a huge deal, actually, because Rahm Emanuel wasn't able to get over 50% of the vote last month. And so that's why he's in this runoff.
That's exactly right. And the race has really been... there's been a lot of transparency issues in this race. I mean, previously we reported in International Business Times that the mayor has moved large sums of money from the city treasury to some of his big campaign donors through shadowy no-contract payments. They're called in Chicago direct voucher payments. And we know that that money has moved to those donor firms. What we don't know is what that money was even for, because the mayor's office has refused to release that information as well. And I think their calculation is probably to try to run out the clock on the election and not disclose this information. But you know, there's been a, you know, there's always a debate when you're doing this kind of reporting about whether you publish a story about a politician's refusal to release information that you could use for a story. And it is my belief as a journalist that when that happens, when the government takes an action to block the release of inherently public information, that unto itself is a story.
And you have also reported on pensions and Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, and we will talk about that later in the show. And maybe we should cover this actually next Friday, the mayoral race in Chicago. The runoff is next Tuesday. And thank you for that, David. That's David Sirota. He's senior editor for investigations for the International Business Times. And what about you, Chris Tonzing? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, if we want to stick with the topic of the U.S.-Iranian or the Iranian-Western nuclear negotiations, then I think your listeners can't do better than following the work of Laura Rosen, R-O-Z-E-N, who has been assigned to this beat for the better part of a decade and really knows the ins and outs of the negotiations and the key issues at stake. She writes for an online-only outlet called El Monitor, AL-Monitor, her sources are highly placed. Her conclusions and tone are always prudent and reasonable, and she's been getting the story right, most importantly, all along, from the Bush administration through the Obama administration. So she's been doing a really good job.
And what do you mean when you say she's been getting the story right?
Well, reading her, you always have an idea of where relations stand between the two parties. You have an idea of what the key sticking points are, but you also have a good sense of how optimistic and or pessimistic negotiators on either side are. And so she has the best reporting on the deal itself also, I said, that I've seen, you know, based on the accounts of people who are in the room, clearly, revealing one detail which I haven't seen elsewhere, which is that it was some creative thinking by the U.S. Energy Secretary, Ernest Moniz, that bridged some of the key technical gaps at the last minute and helped these negotiations to succeed.
All right, so kudos to Laura Rosen, and that is Chris Tonzing. He's editor of the Middle East Report and Information Project, and we will put links to the stories mentioned by Chris and David at yourcallradio.org. So let's talk about this deal, Chris. First off, how historic is this? This is something that you spend a lot of your time really watching and covering.
Yes. The deal has been described by President Obama and many observers as historic, and I think that's accurate. It's a remarkable deal in many respects. One of the things that I think is not being given sufficient weight in our press is that Iran really did make serious and substantial concessions, particularly in view of the fact that everything they have done so far in their nuclear research program is protected activity under the treaty obligations. So they're under no obligation to make these concessions that they have made. They're reducing the size of their centrifuge battery by two-thirds. They have agreed to stop all activity at the plutonium plant, so that blocks that possible path to a nuclear weapon. They have accepted the additional protocol to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, again, which gives the international community the right to conduct surprise snap inspections. So there are very, very rigorous, not only did Iran make big concessions, but there are also very rigorous verification measures and monitoring measures in place in this first step agreement, which will make it almost impossible, and in fact, I think impossible for Iran to cheat on this deal. So it really is a major diplomatic accomplishment for the Obama administration, really should be supported by politicians in both parties. I wish I were optimistic that would happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll talk about that in a minute, but talk a little bit more about these substantial concessions, because you're right. Forbes, for example, their headline is Iranian nuclear deal, a win-win, and we're hearing a lot of analysts frame it that way.
Yeah, I mean, it is a win-win. Iran gets the promise of sanctions relief, which is what they're after. I mean, ultimately, Iran wants to be part of the quote-unquote normal world order. They want to be accepted fully into the community of nations again. They've been a pariah state to one degree or another since the 1979 revolution, and Iranians from the regime on down are very, very tired of their international isolation. But as a first step, they want relief from the punishing economic sanctions, either the unilateral ones, but from the U.S. and other Western nations, and also the U.N. The UN sanctions that have been imposed by the Security Council. In Iran, this agreement is playing well, and you mentioned in your lead-in a key piece of evidence to that fact, which is that President Obama's actual comments were aired unedited, I think, on Iranian state TV, which is a clear signal that the Iranian establishment supports this deal and welcomes it. And it's going to be, at least initially, it's a good deal for the Iranian president to sell it home, because it does have this promise of sanctions relief. For those in the West who are concerned about the prospect of nuclear proliferation, as I mentioned, this deal is very strong. It effectively removes from Iran the capacity to enrich uranium to military grade. It blocks the plutonium route to a weapon. And then I think the real key is is the additional protocol, which means that inspectors from the International Atomic Energy Agency can go in at any time. So there's no question, as opponents of the deal here will say, that Iran is lying, Iran is cheating. That if that were to happen, it would be detected almost instantly, and the West would have a chance to respond in some way. The other thing that is a strong deterrent to the Iranians to cheat on the deal is that the sanctions, there's a snapback mechanism for the sanctions, so that if Iran does not hold its end of the bargain, those sanctions that have been removed would be put back in place. So that's there is a lot in this agreement that will soothe the worries of critics here. My concern is twofold. First, as I said, that Republicans in Congress and even some Democrats will find some way to scuttle this deal before it gets finalized or even after. My second concern is that the rewards to Iran are conditional on Iranian behavior, and they are down the road. And so my concern is that especially if there is strong opposition in Congress here that leads the Iranians to perhaps think twice about their obligations or something like that, that sanctions relief could come too late to provide political benefits and economic benefits that would be seen by the majority of Iranians, and that would make this agreement less popular in Iran. And so that's another way that the deal could, in the long run, fall apart or not be as effective as it could be. But for now, I think we should be of good cheer. I think it is a win-win, and it's a major diplomatic achievement, and it holds out the possibility of ending Iran's international isolation and of making the Middle East a marginally better place. It at least, for now, banishes the specter of another major Middle East war, which is no small accomplishment.
Chris Tunzine is editor of the Middle East Report and Information Project, and David Sirota is senior editor for investigations for the International Business Times. We'll spend about 10 more minutes talking about coverage of this nuclear deal, which is being called historic by President Obama and analysts that closely watch this. And what are your thoughts on how this is being covered? U.S.-Iranian negotiations have been dominating headlines for the past week. So what are your thoughts about this? What questions do you have? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. And then also we'll talk about the larger issues about how Iran is covered, especially in recent years with the war in Syria, their active presence in Iraq. Now we have what's going on in Yemen is just horrible. It's been framed as a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. So what are your thoughts about how Iran is covered in the media? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. David, what are your thoughts about, you know, President Obama's address seemed to target Americans, especially Republicans. Chris was talking about their opposition. And just to read you just a couple headlines that came out in the last few hours, The Wall Street Journal, Republican White House hopefuls condemn Iran deal. The Guardian, Obama fights to contain Republican rebellion over Iran. It just goes on and on. What are your thoughts about how that is being covered?
I mean, I think that one thing we've clearly seen is a foreign policy shift in terms of how the old consensus, in the sense of the president as the leader on foreign policy. I mean, that is clearly that idea is under assault. The Republicans are simply not satisfied with the whole notion that the White House should basically be running foreign policy. I mean, I think there's this double-edged sword there. I think pulling away from the specific policy with Iran and the specific deal with Iran, I think there's, you know, in one sense, it could be seen as encouraging in that the legislative branch has not taken a very active role in foreign policy for a long time, and critics have said that that's a real problem. It's a real constitutional problem. People were asking why were so few legislators speaking up, for instance, during the buildup of the Iraq War to try to get Congress more engaged to limit the scope of that war. So there's been a paradigm shift now. Granted, it's a totally different political situation, but whereby the Republicans are actually asserting the Congress's legislative prerogatives over foreign policy. And you know, I think that is a major shift in the way America has really dealt with foreign policy. I mean, foreign policy has typically been seen as the exclusive purview of the president, and I don't necessarily think there's anything wrong with Congress actually exerting its powers under the Constitution over foreign policy. And I say that without regard to the specific policy. I mean, I don't want to really weigh in on whether I think the Republicans are right or wrong, or whether I think President Obama is right or wrong on the specific policy. But I do think that there has been the so-called imperial presidency, where the Congress simply said whatever the president wants to do is completely fine, and that's not really the way the Constitution was set up to deal with foreign policy. I mean, I will say one other thing about the specific Iran deal. I do think that it has been difficult to get a sense of what the deal actually is, how it will be enforced, because it's been constantly referred to as a framework. I think what's fascinating and somewhat disturbing is that people are making conclusions about a deal whose details are not really yet ironed out. It seems to me that the Republicans are opposed to any kind of engagement whatsoever with Iran at all, because to come to such a conclusion as that party has apparently come to without the deal's details being firmly ironed out suggests that the real opposition by the Republicans is to the entire concept of engagement unto itself. And I think that has kind of been lost in some of the coverage, and I think it needs to be remembered and explored, because that is the fundamental, I think, the fundamental debate that's really at the core of this, is whether the United States really should engage at all with Iran and with countries that are seen as potential adversaries in the region.
And just briefly, Chris, on the issue of what we know and what we don't know, isn't part of the problem. The part of the problem is that these talks have been secretive. There's been no transparency around the negotiations. So journalists are really at the mercy of anonymous sources or people who might leak something about the deal. I mean, how are you getting your information on this deal?
Well, the same way everybody else is, from following it in the news. I do think that, I mean, it's true that the details have yet to be hammered out, the final details. And it's also true that the details of this framework agreement were not 100% known. But I do think that the key issues at stake have been reported and accurately as the negotiations have proceeded. We've had a pretty good idea of what the Iranians' concerns were and what the Western concerns were, and we've had some idea of the various creative solutions that were being proposed by both sides for bridging the gaps. We haven't been completely in the dark, if certainly not if you've been following the issue closely. I do think that President Obama has a pretty big sales job ahead of him. He made a very good start with his initial speech, but he still has quite a bit of work to do in convincing the American people, really, more than the GOP blowhards in Congress, that this deal is good, and it's certainly, as he said yesterday, better than the alternatives. And this is the weak point of the critics, that the critics have really no alternative to a negotiated deal with Iran besides maintaining the status quo, which has led Iran to enrich more and more uranium and get closer and closer to being able to get that to military grade, or war, bombing, or even worse. If there's one thing that I think Americans do not want, it is to get bogged down in yet another military misadventure in the Middle East. So Obama has a sales job ahead of him, but if he sticks to, as he did yesterday, to a very hard-headed, realist analysis of the situation, Iran is a country in its own right. It has its own perceptions of what its interests are, and it's not simply going to roll over and capitulate like the Republicans and the neocons always think it will if we just ratchet up the pressure. Iran is a country in its own right, and it's going to respond favorably to be dealt with respectfully and not disrespectfully. I very much appreciated what the president said in that regard yesterday, too. It shows that he's got a firm understanding of what the politics of this are internationally.
Chris Tonzin is editor of the Middle East Report and Information Project, and David Sirota is senior editor for investigations for the International Business Times. We're talking about coverage of the Iran nuclear deal, and let's hear from Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for a good program. My question is this. I think you, in part, you've answered it. But will the fact that this thing is being signed, negotiated, and will be signed by the major nuclear powers and the Germans, it seems to me,
right?
Will that in any way moderate the stance of the Congress? After all, this thing is not over. One would hope that they would wait until it is negotiated and then be submitted to Congress for some sort of review. I'll stop here, and thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Chris, how's that process going to work?
Well, that's right. The final deal is supposed to be inked in June. I don't know whether or not there will be anything submitted for formal approval to Congress. That's one of the things that has to be hammered out. Mm-hmm. The White House's position, which I think is somewhat defensible historically, is that this could be simply an executive action that would not require any congressional say-so. And, One historical precedent, which is directly on point, is the Algiers Accord of 1981 between the U.S. and Iran, which is essentially a pledge of mutual non-interference in domestic affairs, and that was, of course, signed under President Ronald Reagan. No dove, if I recall. That is, yet to be seen. But the caller made another good point, which President Obama also made, and which I would hope would resonate with people in Congress, which is that this was not just a U.S. initiative, and it was not just the U.S. being pushed by Russia and China either. This was the U.S., France, Britain, and Germany, so our closest European allies, and the fact that they, especially France, which has been the skeptic of the Western powers on this deal throughout.
Well, we'll definitely continue to follow this issue, and I know we have to let you go and we have to go to break. So Chris Tonzin, editor of the Middle East and Information Report, thank you for joining us. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, a program that does rely on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free call no matter where you are. 866-798-8255. If you'd rather write than call, the email address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Half past 10 o'clock is the time. broadcast of Your Call here on Local Public Radio is made possible by KALW listeners and supporters, including Betty Halliday of San Francisco and Renisha Martin of Berkeley.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will have a conversation with Rodessa Jones about a new performance called Birthright. It was developed in collaboration with Planned Parenthood, and it explores issues and the debate surrounding women's reproductive rights. We'll talk about the women impacted by restrictions on access to abortion. We'll talk also about gender violence. I hope you can see this new performance. A lot of women are telling their personal stories, and they talk about the importance of Planned Parenthood. Birthright will be showing at the Brava Theater, debuting April 9th, and you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. We will also be putting together next week shows focusing on Yemen, and we'll also be talking about gender discrimination in Silicon Valley. If you have any show ideas or guest ideas, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And today we are joined by David Sirota, Senior Editor for Investigations for the International Business Times. David recently won an Izzy Award, which is named in memory of the late I.F. Stone, the dissident journalist who challenged McCarthyism and the Vietnam War. We're going to talk with David about all of his exposés on corruption in the country's $3 trillion pension system. But first, David, I want to ask you about a story you just wrote called Indiana Anti-Gay Law. Firms criticize Governor Mike Pence while funding him as he fought LGBT rights. And you write about the fact that Angie's List, for example, Angie's List is getting so much attention for criticizing this new law, threatened to cancel plans for the company's $40 million expansion in Indianapolis. But you write that CEO William Osterler donated $150,000 to Governor Pence's gubernatorial campaign. And he's not the only CEO who did this.
There was a letter from CEOs in which they expressed outrage at the law that Mike Pence, the governor of Indiana, championed and signed. And they expressed outrage about it, the law to effectively permit employment discrimination and other forms of discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. And there's been a lot of news coverage saying the business community, corporations are the ones who were heroic in their efforts to overturn Indiana's law, revise Indiana's law in speaking out. There's been very little reporting about the fact that many of these same companies have been donating tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars to Mike Pence for the last 15 or 20 years, as he has been very, very outspoken for these kinds of laws and against equal rights for LGBT people in the United States. I mean, the example of Angie's List is a good example because it was only a few years ago, as Mike Pence was opposing the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, the federal law bill in Congress to prevent and prohibit employment discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. It was only a few years ago, as Mike Pence was leading the fight against that bill, that the Angie's List CEO gave his gubernatorial campaign $150,000. And there's plenty of other examples. I mean, Eli Lilly, the company, one of its executives is on that letter that was criticizing Mike Pence. I mean, Eli Lilly has been giving Mike, its employees and its political action committee, has been giving Mike Pence large sums of money as he has been taking those positions, taking a real leadership role against equal rights for LGBT people in the United States. And these companies haven't explained why they were effectively financing Mike Pence's political career, a political career predicated on the principles of the very bill that these companies are now saying that they're opposed to. They haven't really explained why they were financing this guy's career. And our story went over which companies were giving him that money. And as I said, on that CEO letter, the example is that the majority of CEOs on that letter expressing outrage about Governor Mike Pence's bill were were represent companies whose employees and political action committees were giving large sums of cash to Mike Pence as he was promising to promote that kind of bill.
So what are your thoughts on why that angle isn't getting more attention? Because these companies are getting a lot of attention for speaking out against this law and for saying that they might not do business there or they might not bring their conferences there.
Well, it's a good question as to why that hasn't gotten more attention. I think the assumption among the political reporting class is that the money from those companies flowed to Mike Pence because of Mike Pence's positions on economic issues, not necessarily his position on so-called social issues, and that therefore that's acceptable. I think that's part of the political calculation that goes unquestioned in the United States. And I think that that there needs to be an awareness here that that there is a fundamental hypocrisy in companies pretending that they support equal rights while they are financing the political careers of people who are promising and leading the public fight against equal rights. And the hope is that the reporting that we've done and the reporting that, that maybe others will ultimately do will actually at least shine a spotlight on where that hypocrisy exists.
Pando Daily also had a piece saying that Google, Microsoft, and other big high-tech firms are funding ultra-conservative Ted Cruz, who agrees with Governor Pence, along with all of the other Republicans running for president. And these tech companies are also coming out and slamming the law. But as you said, it's not just journalists. I mean, a lot of people in the public are very cynical at this point and think, well, yeah, that's what companies these days do. They fund everybody, frankly, regardless of where they stand, because they want access.
Yeah, I think that's. I think there's something to that, absolutely. But I also think that let's not forget that this set of issues that's going on right now is not necessarily one in which corporations perceive their own economic power to be on the line. And to be more straightforward about it, is that I think the companies that are coming out and saying that they don't like what Mike Pence did, they see it as an easy way to portray themselves as for equality and against discrimination without having to really do anything that is perceived to be a challenge to their own economic power. And so it's an easy way for them to brand themselves as tolerant, even though many of them in many different ways have been funding politicians who've been not for equal rights, and many other companies that have done that continue to do things that belie the idea that they're against employment discrimination. I mean, there's another example that the New York Times raised, although it didn't point this out, which is that Walmart. There was a big story in the New York Times that Walmart is leading the fight for against employment discrimination. It's spoken out against what the governor of Arkansas was going to do. Is going to sign a similar law to Indiana. Largely unmentioned is the fact that Walmart is a place that has fired people for wanting to join a union. That's a kind of a dictionary definition of employment discrimination. And so I think that what's going on here underneath is that Walmart sees that it can come out and say, hey, we're against discrimination because we're against this law which deals with employment discrimination against people on the basis of sexual orientation. And Walmart gets to get a great, nice New York Times story out of that and not mention the fact that it has been actively engaged in employment discrimination on the basis of other things.
Well, and also it faced the largest sexual harassment class action lawsuit in the history of this country. Diana Furtgott Roth, former chief economist of the U.S. Department of Labor, wrote an op-ed in Marketplace saying that Indiana is a state that has followed the example of 19 other states and the federal government in passing a Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Such laws have been around for more than 20 years and have never been found unconstitutional, yet people are calling for a boycott of only Indiana. She says that makes no sense. If the law is so damaging, why not call for its repeal throughout America? So what do you think about some context in all of the coverage that we're seeing?
Yeah, I certainly think that's a very fair point. And I think there are some differences with the Indiana law and some of the other states' laws, but in general, I think that's a very important point. And there's a question of why has Indiana become the flashpoint? I mean, frankly, I've been I've been surprised that anybody is surprised about Mike Pence and Indiana. People say, you know, they can't believe that this would happen in Indiana or with Mike Pence. It's kind of like when you say that, what you're really saying is you just haven't been paying attention. You don't know much about that state or Mike Pence's long political career. I think why has Indiana become the flashpoint? It's a good question. I don't think there's one good answer here. I also think that while there is a hypocrisy involved in saying, well, we're going to not travel to Indiana, but we'll travel to all these other states that have similar laws, while that hypocrisy is important to spotlight, I also don't think it necessarily means that the pressure on Indiana to change is necessarily misguided. I do think, though, an even deeper issue is where do the lines get drawn about what's acceptable and what's not acceptable? We had another story at International Business Times about how some of the governors who have said that they are banning state travel to state-subsidized travel to Indiana, these are governors who are either just went on or are planning trips to countries like China and Cuba. I mean, the governor of New York is literally planning a trip to Cuba right now while saying there can be no state-sponsored trip travel to Indiana. Cuba does not exactly have a stellar record on LGBT rights, and it does not necessarily have a stellar record on all sorts of other human rights. Same thing goes for China. And so one question to think about is, where are the lines drawn? Where are those lines drawn? And I think especially when it comes to a place like China, governors going to China but then criticizing Indiana, I think what that speaks to, again, it goes back to this economic issue, which is that it's easy to speak out on an issue that's perceived to not necessarily challenge institutional economic power, but it is difficult to take actions and speak out against countries or policies that in speaking out would challenge economic power, like China and like all the businesses that have a vested interest in doing business in China.
David Sirota is senior editor for Investigations for the International Business Times, and you can find his report about the companies that are criticizing the religion law in Indiana have also funded Governor Mike Pence's campaign. A couple of those companies include Angie's List. They're getting a lot of attention in the media. Anthem, Eli Lilly, and you can find that at yourcallradio.org. David also recently won an Izzy Award, which is named in memory of the late I.F. Stone, the dissident journalist who challenged McCarthyism and the Vietnam War. And the judges specifically pointed out David's exposés on corruption in the country's $3 trillion pension system. Now, these stories that you've written, David, are just kind of jaw-dropping because the way that pensions are framed, and this is very simplistic, but it's, you know, they're very expensive. The states don't have money. There's just too much going to people, although it's rarely broken down in terms of high-level executives and then people who don't make, you know, over, let's say, $80,000 a year, $100,000 a year. But the angle that you took is that the judges of the award said that abuses hurt taxpayers and the government employees while rewarding Wall Street firms that fatten politicians' campaign coffers. First off, take us back and talk about why you decided to focus on pensions and then how you came about really exploring that angle.
Well, pensions are some of the largest pools of capital in the world. America's public pensions, whether in the city or the state level, and they get relatively little attention from reporters, from rank and file voters. They get lots of attention from the most powerful people in the world, Wall Street money managers. So there's a really fundamental imbalance in terms of how much attention is paid to public pensions versus how important they are. I made a comment to a friend yesterday as an example that I could give you two people that you and lots of people have probably never heard of that are more important than probably 90% of the U.S. Senate and lots of famous U.S. senators. I mean, I'm the comptroller of the state of New York and the state treasurer of North Carolina. These people singularly, they don't deal with anybody else. They singularly control hundreds of billions of dollars. They are, and they're just two examples. I mean, they're way more powerful than most U.S. senators that get tons of attention. And the reason is because they can move hundreds of billions of dollars at the drop of a hat into different investments that generate huge amounts of fees and that potentially affect the retirement payments, the promised retirement payments, to hundreds of thousands of workers. And so this is the way I got into this reporting, is to look at basically what are the largest unguarded pools of capital in the world, and how those decisions about where to invest that money, how those decisions are made, and the intersection between politics and those decisions being made, particularly political campaign contributions. You've got huge amounts of money that relatively few media outlets are paying any attention to, huge amounts of money that large sums of teachers, firefighters, police officers, and other government workers are relying on for their subsistence income in retirement, and you've got politicians who take huge sums of money from Wall Street firms that want to earn fees off of that money. Those politicians are making the decisions about which investment houses get that money. And the question then becomes, are the investment decisions made with the interests of the retirees in mind in terms of the best returns, or are those decisions made in the interests of the Wall Street firms who are giving campaign contributions to the politicians and who want to charge huge fees to those public pension systems, fees that effectively come out of the retirement savings of hundreds of thousands of government workers?
David Sirota is senior editor for investigations for the International Business Times. He just won an Izzy Award for his exposés on corruption in the country's $3 trillion pension system. If you have any questions about pensions, specifically media coverage, because, was it last year? I just remember pensions were in the news on a regular basis for a few months. So what are your thoughts on how pensions are covered in the media? And are you seeing stories like David's, where the stories actually look at the fact that Wall Street firms are rewarded that fatten politicians' campaign coffers, and how the pension system really runs in this country? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Now, one of your major investigations, David, has been about New Jersey's pension system. And you wrote that New Jersey has sent more pension money to big-name Wall Street firms like Blackstone, the Carlyle Group, some of these I'd never heard of before, Elliott Associates, Omega Advisors. The amount of fees the state pays financial managers has more than tripled since Chris Christie assumed office. New Jersey is now one of America's largest investors in hedge funds, paying $250 million in additional annual fees to Wall Street firms, many of whose employees have financially supported Republican groups backing Chris Christie's reelection campaign. First off, can you explain how the process works in terms of how the pension money is sent to these Wall Street firms?
Sure. Traditionally, pension money had been invested in stocks and bonds, stock index funds and bonds, a traditional 60-40 mix, until about 15 years ago, when money started moving into so-called alternative investments. These are they're called actively managed investment vehicles that charge higher fees, very, very high fees, with the supposed promise that these investments will beat the market, will beat the very low-fee stock index funds and low-fee bonds. And so what's gone on is that these money managers in private equity firms, hedge funds, venture capital firms, and real estate investment firms will come to a pension system and say, we've got this supposedly great investment that will charge you high fees, but we're going to promise to deliver you better returns than you get if you put your money in a boring stock index fund. You'll pay us the high fees. We'll supposedly deliver you better returns for retirees, and everyone will be happy. The problem is, of course, is that the alternative investments over the last 15 years have not delivered better returns than the stock market. And you don't have to trust me about that. Warren Buffett is now out there publicly saying that these kinds of investments are completely inappropriate for public pension funds. But the big jackpot, of course, has been for the alternative investment industry. New Jersey is a good example. In the last 5 years, New Jersey has spent $1.5 billion in disclosed financial fees to financial firms from its pension. That's $1.5 billion taken out of its pension fund to pay financial managers for a portfolio that has delivered below median results and that has been specifically completely outpaced by the very low fee S&P stock index fund. It has been a huge jackpot for, as I said, private equity, hedge fund firms, some of whose executives have made large campaign contributions to the organization supporting Governor Christie, in chronological proximity, I might add, to when those firms got those pension management deals. And so I think New Jersey stands as a really illustrative example, and it stands as that example of what's been going on at precisely a time when the governor has simultaneously said that the pension system supposedly doesn't have enough money to pay promised retirement benefits. So it apparently has plenty of money to spend on Wall Street fees on firms that deliver below median results, but it doesn't have enough money to pay out the promised pension benefits to retirees.
Well, so what about that argument? Because that is what we hear from state and just government officials in general, that we just don't have the money. These payouts are just too high and the whole system needs to be reformed.
Well, I certainly think that pension systems face funding shortfalls. I think it's important to remember two things. Where do those shortfalls come from, and what can be done about those shortfalls? Those shortfalls come primarily because from two reasons, really, that politicians have not been making the required pension payments over a number of years. The workers have been making their pension payments that they've negotiated with a contract, but it's as if the employer, as if you had a promised 401k and your employer just suddenly told you 10 years later that they hadn't been making the contributions that you had. And then the employer would have the nerve to come back to you and say, sorry, can't pay your pension, but can't pay your retirement benefits that I was supposed to be putting money into, and now it's your fault that you're bankrupting the company, even though it was, of course, the employer that wasn't putting the money in. So I think it's important to understand that context, and also there were some significant losses from the financial crisis, which, of course, those losses were largely engineered by, or at least, you know, the responsible parties were the Wall Street firms that are now benefiting from the pension system's shift into Wall Street investment. And some of that shift has been justified as we need to big bet our way out of these pension shortfalls by putting money into riskier and riskier, higher fee investments on Wall Street. So it's important to remember where that comes from. The other thing that's important to remember when it comes to pension shortfalls is how to deal with them and how big they are. I mean, you hear these numbers, you know, $30 billion, $40 billion, $60 billion, $100 billion, and that's in a vacuum. Mm. But it needs to be seen as that is a 30-year number. If you own a house and I tell you the size of your mortgage, the entire size of your mortgage, that sounds a lot more intimidating than if I tell you the size of your monthly payment. So it's important. Well, the problem with the media coverage has been is that these large numbers are put out there without contextualizing them as 30-year numbers. Mm. It's like saying, you know, you owe X for your entire mortgage. You say, wow, that's I don't know how, that's an impossible number. And then you say, well, actually, that number is a 30-year number. Here's the monthly number. Now, granted, we've had a housing crisis where people have gotten too big mortgages, but the point is that there has not been enough context for how relatively manageable this problem is. I mean, pension payments, to make required pension payments that would make most systems whole, require about 0.3% of a state or city's budget every year. That seems pretty manageable.
And David, I think we should do a show about this just because there are so many layers and you've got so much great information about what's going on in Chicago. We just had someone post a comment on our website saying San Francisco City Employees Retirement Board wants to invest with hedge funds. This is a big issue, not getting much transparency or attention. So we'll definitely do a show. But I also wanted to go back to media coverage because in one of your exposés, The Wolf of Sesame Street, which you wrote for Pando Daily, you revealed that New York's public television station, WNET,
yeah.
Yes, thank you.
Right.
WNET accepted a $3.5 million donation from a billionaire anti-pension activist to fund coverage of the pension issue. The station was forced to return the money, and PBS's ombudsman wrote of, quote, ethical compromise and funding arrangements that nobody really knew about until David Sirota wrote about it. So what are your thoughts on how this is covered? The Izzy Award judges said that a lot of your reporting led to investigations, passage of legislation, and changes in government practices.
Well, I think, you know, what happened with the PBS thing, I think, was was a clear violation of PBS's rules. I mean, PBS took money from a billionaire who was playing an active political role in trying to cut public pensions. I mean, he was a guy who contributed to the potential ballot initiative in California. To show you how twisted it became on PBS, PBS did an episode, had a segment on the ballot initiative. Their segment was funded by the same guy who was funding the ballot initiative, and that was not disclosed. I mean, so that was a really egregious example. I think that, you know, media coverage of this issue has, I think, for various reasons, has not properly contextualized the total pension shortfalls, and I would argue even worse, has not focused on the fee side of this. I'll go back to New Jersey as an example. The New Jersey pension system just had the governor just had a pension reform commission that put out ideas about how to deal with the pension shortfalls. It was a commission that was all financial executives, including the chair, who was a former Goldman Sachs executive. And New Jersey has investments with Goldman Sachs. And all of the recommendations surrounded were about cutting benefits. There was not a single mention in their report about reducing the fees, $1.5 billion in fees over the last 5 years. Not a single mention of reducing those fees. New Jersey is now paying $600 million a year in financial fees. There was not a single mention in that report about reducing those fees. And so, and subsequently in the media coverage, there was no mention of fees and how big those fees are, a year. And just to contextualize it, the whole debate over the state's pension funding shortfall is about whether the governor is going to make required about $1.5 billion pension payments. $600 million a year is not all $1.5 billion of the needed annual pension contribution.
And David, unfortunately, we're out of time, but we definitely have to do a show about this and focus more on your reporting and what you found. David Sirota is senior editor for investigations for the International Business Times. He won an Izzy Award for his exposés on the country's $3 trillion pension system. Thanks so much, David, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Bay Area artist and cultural odyssey director Rodessa Jones about Birthright, a new performance developed in collaboration with Planned Parenthood of Northern California. It explores questions, issues, and the debate surrounding reproductive rights. Who are the women and girls impacted by restrictions on access to abortion and gender-based violence? How are they fighting back, and what are their stories? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Nock Nguyen produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.